Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
And welcome to Defrag. So this morning, what have we talked about so far? We talked about McAfee telling how to uninstall his own software, which was pretty hilarious if you haven't seen it.
There's some videos on YouTube.
Yeah. And then we talked about, I was going to upgrade my motherboard on my home PC last night. And mm-hmm. I was looking around some different motherboards. And I found one that I liked, which you have already
promptly
talked me out of. The one I liked was the Asus P9X79. I've got an Asus board now.
Mm-hmm.
And you made a good point.
Well, the point that I was making was with Haswell just being released,
yeah,
you'll want to get a motherboard that has a compatible socket type, and I believe for the Haswell's i7s is a socket 1150.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular motherboard is a socket 2011.
Yeah.
And supposedly it was only tested or rated for the second gen Core 2s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're going to upgrade the motherboard, you're already taking the time to do it, then I would say get something future-proof at least reasonably well and go to something that'll take Haswell chips.
So the reason I was excited about this one, though, is it had 8 DIMM slots for RAM. And so you could have 64 gig of RAM.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do a RAM disk. I was going to do half of that, 32 gig as a RAM disk, because I looked up, there's a site, laptopmag.com, I'll link to it in the show notes. But it was talking about how if you have a RAM disk, it's like 10 times faster than an SSD.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, wow, I can really just let this machine fly. But then when we started talking about that, first of all, I was looking at this utility here, data RAMs, RAM disk. And when you use that, its maximum's 4 gigs. So right there is kind of...
Well, I mean, there's some definite advantages to a RAM disk, right? It kind of really depends on what you're going to be using it for.
Yeah.
So you said you wanted to use it for Photoshop,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, and video rendering.
Video
stuff
rendering,
like that, yeah.
So as a RAM disk, temporary storage, perfect solution.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just throwaway stuff. If you're trying to install applications to it, though, that becomes a lot more problematic because, well, you turn off the system and it's gone. You have to have some way of backing that to something that is non-volatile.
Mm-hmm. This saves when you exit as a file. Now, one of the other things
as long as you don't as long as you don't lose power, you know, you have to have UPS attached to it.
Yep.
Because you can't guarantee that, you know, your system won't bug check either, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
some things can go wrong. Just because it will save to a file at the end doesn't mean that it is guaranteed to save.
Yeah, and when I saw the 4 gig limit, I was like, well, I'll just use it as a swap file then, not even thinking that's ridiculous.
Right, because you don't want to use RAM to emulate a swap file that is meant to be on disk, which is supposed to emulate RAM.
It's like a house of mirrors now. So that was just bad reasoning altogether. But one of the things I would like to do with a 32 gig RAM disk like this is, like, if you look at the videos we shoot here in the studio, we're doing 4 camera, each shooting HD. Our bottleneck when you do a multi-camera edit into one file is that you can't read off the disk fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
Write to it fast enough. So having a RAM disk like that might help if you're rendering video and you copy all the videos to the RAM disk and then you render to the RAM disk.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a good use case, but still you've kind
of... And if you're working with less than 4 gig files, technically there's nothing stopping you from creating multiple 4 gig RAM disks.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? So, and I'm fairly certain that there are RAM disks out there in software that will go beyond the 4 gig limit. I know that there are hardware RAM disks. You can get them as PCI add-in cards that will take DIMM slots or DIMM memory right on them that can go beyond 4 gig.
Yeah,
they're extremely expensive.
It kind of like, it took the wind out of the whole spirit of wanting to do this on my own.
I mean, if you're making a rendering machine though, you know, do you want to spend, you know, $1,000, $1,200 every year trying to upgrade it, or do you want to spend $4,000 on a machine that, you know, is going to be super, super powerful? You know, you could basically turn it into a small cluster, you know, mm-hmm. get a couple of them and turn it into a cluster rendering array.
Yeah, it's, it might not be a bad idea for the studio.
Right.
But
for
not
home?
For home.
Well.
And by studio, I mean not my money paying for it. So, yeah. All right, well, let's get started. From Tomas, he says, I know you talked about the 7660 exam in one of your episodes. I was planning on taking this exam later this year, but according to this page, it's being retired. Does that mean I won't be able to take this exam after the end of July? Is there a replacement for this exam? If no, why is Microsoft retiring it? Anything else you could suggest?
So this is the Microsoft Learning Certification exam page. Mm-hmm. These are the exams that are listed to retire in the next 12 months. If you take a look at the 7660s, the Windows internal exam, and you'll notice that the technology was based on Server 2008. It was published in 2008. It's a relatively old exam by today's standards. So while it's being retired, I would expect that it would be replaced by a later version. Mm-hmm. There's nothing listed that says that it will be absolutely be replaced, so I can't say for certain, but I'd expect it for something like this that there would be a replacement.
Yeah, and if you're planning to take this exam now or before it retires,
there's no harm.
There's no reason in not doing that, is there?
Well, other than the fact that it's based off of, you know,
it's not like it's a waste of time. This is still good information.
It's still relevant information, especially if these are the type of systems that you're interacting with. But you got to remember, Server 2008 was released in 2007-ish. Mm-hmm. This is the same era as Vista.
Yeah.
So we had Windows 7 after that, and we had Windows 8 after that. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about, you know, being two generations now, almost three generations older.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have any of the new latest changes that are in the later operating systems. And there's a significant amount of changes, especially in Server 2012 and 2008 R2.
Okay. So you're saying I shouldn't learn COBOL? That's what you're saying.
Well, unless you're going to be employed by someone that will leverage your skills.
By a bank from the 80s.
Right. Yeah. If you can go back in time, I think you'd be golden.
All right. From Greg, love the show, guys. Just a few questions. Can you install an OS from an ISO file when booting to a VHD? And can you install Linux to a VHD you are booting to? If so, are there limitations to the specific distro? Can you use BitLocker or some other full disk encryption method? So, yeah, are we doing Linux support now?
Some others might. I personally don't.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the first one. Can you install?
Can you install an OS from an ISO file?
There's nothing prohibiting you from doing that. Mm-hmm. You need a way of mounting the ISO.
Yeah.
Right. Most people will burn it to DVD first. Mm-hmm. You can boot into the WinPE portion. Create your VHD, and then install from the ISO into that VHD. So there's absolutely nothing stopping you from doing that.
Yeah.
As for Linux within a VHD, we don't do anything to specifically disallow it.
Yeah.
Right. So whatever support is probably out there on the internet for those of you that want to try.
Yeah.
But I don't know specifically about booting from the VHD with Linux on it because I've never tried it. All I know is that, yes, you can do it,
it shouldn't be a problem, Windows but OSs. We just haven't tried that here, so.
Right, and I mean, whether or not it works or not, we don't technically support it.
Yeah. Okay, next question. How much RAM is necessary for a RAM? Oh, another RAM disk question. For a RAM disk, and how does one determine how much to allocate? Also, what programs benefit from being put on a RAM disk since the contents are lost when the machine is powered off? I was thinking of putting some Microsoft Office products in the RAM disk, for example, Word, since the user always chooses where the documents are saved. I heard on Windows 7 RAM disk is obsolete since Superfetch does its job. Is it as simple as that?
Wow. Okay, so I want to talk about the last part of it first.
Yeah.
So Superfetch, I believe we touched upon this in the last show.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different technology, different usage than what you'd use a RAM disk for.
Yeah.
Superfetch is all about trying to improve random read access for your programs.
Yeah.
You know, it's supposed to go and fetch what it thinks is going to be the next
intelligently.
Call. Intelligently. What it thinks is going to be the next call that you're trying to make. So it's not constantly hitting the disk in an unintelligent way on an as-needed basis.
So it's somewhat like when they put like RAM or memory in a hard drive to try
those hybrid disks.
Yeah. So trying to make things faster
right.
by pulling out the information and things you're gonna and or what it anticipates,
right,
and having it ready for you.
Right, and that's so, that's the purpose of Superfetch.
Yeah.
Now a RAM disk, and we've talked about this earlier, is its whole purpose in life is to make a section of your RAM look exactly like a drive, write files to it, read files from it, and it's just meant to be an extremely fast medium.
Mm-hmm.
It's best for temporary information. Again, if you try to install Office, technically nothing is going to stop you from doing it.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a way of backing up that file prior to rebooting the system or a power loss,
yeah,
then that's gone.
Yeah.
So you need a way of backing that up to non-volatile memory, which yeah. is, you know, a real
and
disk.
So there was an article that I was reading about last night when I was looking at this motherboard, but it talks about how fast things open, whether you're using just a hard drive and RAM, SSD, and SSD with a RAM disk.
Mm-hmm.
And the speeds are very, very fast if you're using an SSD for your primary system mm-hmm. with a RAM disk. But they had installed the software to the RAM disk, which we already talked about. It's going to be a little wobbly.
Was limiting.
Yeah. But the speed difference is negligible for SSD to SSD with a RAM disk. So I think just an SSD mm-hmm. is going to be your best bet. And then go that route.
Right.
All right. Next question. I'd like to send a message to a group chat from the Windows command line. I know the chat name from Skype. Let's say it's test chat. What's the easiest way to do that?
You'd probably need another program because there is, as far as I know, nothing built into the Windows command line utility mm-hmm. that will allow you to send to anything in Skype.
Yeah.
Skype could produce a command line version. I've not, again, seen anything like that.
Yeah.
If there's a Linux version or a Unix version of Skype that has a command line option, you might try recompiling it mm-hmm. into a Windows version and see if that'll work.
Yeah.
But again, there's nothing built in for command line chat to Skype.
Yeah.
That I know of.
Yeah, I typically think of Skype as an audio and video utility anyway. I never really use it for text chat.
I mean, free SMS, right?
But yeah, I mean, I'm using Link, so. All right, next question.
For now.
Yeah. How can I move, not copy all files with the same extension from hundreds of subdirectories into a single folder without overwriting same name files? Well, the way that I'll talk about the way I do that, and then you can append it with the way you do it, which I would say is the correct way. I would just do a **, search every file in the subdirectories and the root directory, copy all those files into the directory you want to move them to, and wait until you get the dialog that says, what do you want to do? There's a duplicate, and just say, rename the file to a second one, and that way you're keeping all of them, and it should do that. How would you do it?
That's actually the exact same way I do it.
Wow.
In Windows Explorer, using the search will conglomerate,
all right. Pull together. Sure.
All of the files, it'll when you use the search, it'll put it all into one window, and you just select them and move them just as Larry suggested. That's the fastest way, you know, if you're doing it ad hoc. You can also do, you know, robocopy commands, PowerShell scripts that will do it if you want to specially craft it, if you want to rename them to something very specific. You can do that as well.
Yeah, and I would probably also, I try to sort by name and then try to find a file that had a duplicate right under it and start copying from there, hopefully get that dialogue going in the beginning rather than the end. Would that even
The dialogue will always show at the end. It'll resolve everything. It'll try and copy everything first, and it'll just wait to the end in order to resolve conflicts.
Okay, all right. Next question. I just did a drag and drop on a Windows system to move a large number of files. During the move, there were a few errors involving corrupt files and other issues. Since I was doing this overnight, I checked the Do This With All Other Files button. The question is there a log somewhere that would have recorded these errors and which files had done what with them?
There is no log file that would have recorded this.
Yeah.
There may be events that were thrown in the event log, but I believe you have to turn on the debug channel in order for that to actually work in Event Viewer.
Okay. Next question. I'm looking for software or tricks so I can lock applications by their title. My goal is preventing target applications from running. There is some software that that prevent applications from running by their executable's file name, but in this way, if the user changes the application's executable name, he can run it easily. So what's the solution?
The solution is AppLocker.
Okay.
It's primarily enterprise-based. Now, what AppLocker will do is a set of policies that you can disallow applications via hash, via signatures. This is exactly what this would be used for.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you change the file name to, because if you say disallow it based on hash, then the file name isn't technically part of the hash that it would use, so mm-hmm. it's able to find out, oh, it doesn't matter how you rename it, where you copy it to, whatever, it will just not allow this particular file from running. Now, since this is the enterprise-based version, right, that may be a little bit out of scope for, say, the home user from doing it. Now, poor man's approach is just using ACLs and basically saying, you know...
Explain what an ACL is.
It's your access control list. It's basically saying what rights you have in order to execute a file. Now, if you're worried about this in a home situation, you know, kids, somebody messing around, mm-hmm. launching applications that they shouldn't, reduce their rights, you know, make them standard users. They're not able to execute software from outside of their normal locations. They're not allowed to install software.
Yeah.
You can really lock down the system with NTFS permissions, right? So if you're worried about them renaming a file, well, don't allow them to copy the file to any other location. And you can set up ACLs on their on the places that they can write to, like their documents folder, mm-hmm. to not allow execute permissions. So you can say, like, even if they copy the exe to that location and they rename it, well, they can't actually execute it because they don't have rights to do so. So, yeah, there are a few different things. In an enterprise-based scenario, though, I'd say AppLocker is your best bet to actually disallow that.
Cool. Okay. Next question, shutting down Windows 7, how to get an app to start up automatically and run briefly and then close. I want the app to briefly show on the screen or briefly say on the speakers, my reminder to self, unplug USB stick, turn off heater before leaving room. After that, Windows 7 shuts down. So if that's what you want, I mean, you just want some audio that plays, hey, do this. Here's what I would do. I would just record a WAV file of you saying that and mm-hmm. then use that as your shutdown sound.
Yep.
Done deal.
That's the super easy way of doing it, and it's actually relatively elegant. I like that.
Okay.
Another approach would be, you know, if you wanted to have a visual indication, not just an audio indication, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can also create a shortcut on your desktop
yeah.
that will launch the app to show you what you want to do and then run the shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can just say shutdown, the shutdown command.
Yeah.
Just call that. If you need something visual or you need something that's more blocking than just the sound.
Yeah.
Yeah, so either approach. But I like the WAV file approach because that one's quick and dirty.
Cool. Oh, I got two today that you liked. All right, so pick of the week time. It is time for the pick of the week. And my pick of the week this week is Build. The Build conference is going to be starting the day after I post this video. Maybe the same day I post this video. We'll see. But you definitely want to be watching Channel 9 Live. We're going to be live. We're going to have a ton of awesome guests, as we always do at Build. Larry Osterman's going to be on site, so we'll have him. We'll be interviewing Scott Gu. Let's see, who else? Tim Heuer. All kinds of great, great guests. We're going to have Doug Crockford there. And lots of old familiar faces and a lot of Charles Torrey hosting it. So you definitely want to be watching Build on Channel 9 Live. We'll have the videos up after the event, but live, you get to interact with these people and send us your questions. And as always, send us your questions because we love getting them. So that was the first one. Then the other one was bug bounties.
Yeah, so Windows has, for Build going forward, has created a couple of bounties for the security community. And, I mean, we've done similar things in the past, but these are actually kind of cool. There's a few of them here. The mitigation bypass boundary, where Microsoft will pay $100,000 for novel exploitation techniques. So that's, you know, if you're able to crack patch guard or if you're able to get out of an app container, you know, these kinds of scenarios. And you get an additional $50,000 if you can come up with a really good mitigation for your bypass.
Yeah, very nice. So some white hat ways to actually profit from hacking.
Yeah,
I love it.
And I mean, this is great because, you know, you are helping to improve the product for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. So you're getting your name recognized, you're making good chunk of change, good chunk of change.
Yeah.
And you know, you're just making it better for everybody in the future.
Very nice. Perfect. Okay. All right, well, that's the show for this week. If you have questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com. Leave comments in the show notes. We love to get the email, so we'll see you next week.
Take care.